Please welcome Henry Cook talking Number Station's Cold War Short Waves.
That was a recording made on the 26th of November 1995 by a radio amateur in Hull.
Six, six, four, seven, five.
It was broadcast unscrambled on a standard shortwave frequency, the same part of the broadcast spectrum used by the World Service or any number of Midwestern religious talk radio stations. Anyone could hear it on a standard household radio.
1, 9, 2, 7, 4.
Shortwave radio can get a long way around the world under the right conditions. It sort of bounces off a layer of the atmosphere and again off the Earth. It kind of ricochets around the world and over the horizon, which means that the transmitter for this signal could have been anywhere in Europe easily, maybe even further, as could the intended recipient.
7, 8, 4, 9, 4.
The wonderfully named Enigma 2000, a group of radio enthusiasts linked by the internet, eventually tracked this particular transmission to this site in Cyprus. And he managed it because this was not a one-off transmission. This particular station broadcast regularly from the late 1980s through to 2008, and it wasn't alone. Until recently, there were loads of these stations in the shortwave spectrum, blatting out streams of seemingly random numbers, Morse, tones, or data, all unscrambled, all out there for anyone to hear. And they were nicknamed the number stations by the radio community, who have been merrily theorizing about their existence for decades. These stations are unlicensed and unlisted. Legally, they're anonymous. Which is strange when you consider the resources that you would need to run a station like this. You need power, for a start. You need a lot of power to run a powerful radio station. You also need people to run that station, and you need real estate for the transmission towers. And you need time. Many of these stations broadcast for decades uninterrupted, and you'd think that pirates this powerful would have been shut down with extreme prejudice by any government that cared about keeping its radio spectrum policed. So this leads to the theory that they must have been operated by governments themselves, which leads to the question, why would a government need a high-power, long-range, deniable radio station? The theory goes that these were used to communicate with intelligence agents in the field. It's no coincidence, these theories say, that these stations were at the peak of their activity during the Cold War. This particular site in Cyprus was known to be used by the BBC and the UK military, and the station that broadcast from there became known as the Lincolnshire Posher because of the electronic version of the folk song that it used as a call sign. It was one of the most well-known and consistent of the number stations. So, I'm sure some of you are wondering, if these stations were clandestine communications channels, how did they keep their communications secret? Bearing in mind that they're broadcasting in the clear. So the theory says that Well, most people reckon that it was they used a one-time pad system. Now, a one-time pad system is theoretically unbreakable, and it first came to widespread use during World War II. And despite its security, it's actually very simple. It can be decoded by hand with a bit of simple maths. And the key is the so-called one-time pad, a list of random numbers. But the important thing is that they're truly random numbers. Rumor has it that when this crypto system was being developed at Bletchley Park during the war, these streams of random numbers were generated with a tombola, or a room full of tombolas, and a room full of hapless conscripts pulling wooden balls endlessly out of this tombola, generating streams of random numbers. More modern systems use things like radioactive decay. There have been lava lamps used as random number generators, or webcams in boxes using the static. But however you get your stream of random numbers, to use them with a one-time pad, you make another copy of that stream of one-time numbers. So you have a pad that you've written a load of random numbers in, you copy that, and then you have two copies of this particular stream of random numbers, and they're the only two copies in the world of that particular stream of random numbers. So you keep one copy of that particular stream of random numbers in your top secret government headquarters, preferably guarded by a couple of dangerous looking chaps, and you send the other copy out with your operative. And then at a prearranged time, you send out a message, you send out a message encrypted using your copy of that pad. Your operative decrypts it using their copy of one page off that pad, and then you both destroy your copies of that particular page off the pad, hence one-time pad. You only ever use one sheet once. Simple. And theoretically, unbreakable. Now, despite its security, it does have one point of weakness, the one-time pad system, and that's the pad itself. Your operative out in the field has a physical copy of that pad, and they have to keep it secret for sometimes years at a time. So this particular image that I'm showing you here is of a one-time pad that was found under the hood of a toy truck by the Canadian Secret Intelligence Service in the 1960s. And on the end there, that's an actual micro dot reader used to read the particular copy of that one-time pad. In 1988, Special Branch in London raided the apartment of a Dutch art dealer named Erwin van Haarlem. Turned out that Erwin was not a Dutch art dealer, or not entirely a Dutch art dealer. He was actually an operative of a Czech intelligence service, and the Special Branch found copies of one-time pads hidden around his apartment inside bars of soap. So, in order to show you all how the one-time pad system works, I thought we'd do a little decryption exercise. Now, there should have been little bits of paper circulating as you came in. So we're going to be using those in a few minutes. But first, we need to get into the right mindset, OK? So I need you all to imagine, EMF camp, that you're spies. And you're in deep cover behind enemy lines. You're miles from home. Every day is a test of your tradecraft. One word, one look, one little reaction out of place might give you away. But you're good, EMF. You're all really good spies. You manage to maintain your legend. Now you have one connection back home, a shortwave radio. And at the right times, you sit down, you take your shortwave radio and a notepad, and you wait. The signal comes through. You copy down the numbers, knowing later when you decrypt it that you are the only person in the world who can decrypt this particular message. In a second, I'm going to play you a message that was broadcast on the 21st of December 1991 by a station which was nicknamed NNN by Enigma, who reckon it was used by the Austrian Army Intelligence Office. So you should all have found your sheet by now. Now, there are some numbers already there. That's your one-time pad. And we're going to copy down the numbers from the broadcast like this, in the second row of the pad. The third row in each group is for decoding. The message is made of four groups of five numbers and each group is repeated twice. So don't worry if you miss any numbers, because they're going to come around a second time. And the message begins with a call sign and a group identifier at the start, so we know it's for us. And we are group 70. Everyone got that? Good.
Group 70. 6 2 8 8 6 6 2 8 8 6 0 3 1 8 6 0 3 1 8 2 6 3 1 9 2 6 3 1 9.
So if you were paying attention, you should have ended up with something like this. And of course you were paying attention because you're all very good spies. Now, the decryption method is dead simple. I'm sure some of you are probably part way there already. And I would say that part of the fun of this is figuring out for yourself. So basically, as soon as I describe this, some of you are going to get it. And I'm going to ask you to just keep it to yourself till a bit later when we're all going to go through it, because it's fun to do it for yourself. So all you need to do is add the numbers that were already on the pad to the numbers from the broadcast, and then look up the letter in that lookup table across the bottom. Here's an example. 8 plus 6 is 14, which gives you N. Now, in some cases, you're going to go over 26. In that case, loop back round to 1 and keep going. That's adding mod 26, or subtracting 26, either way. And there's only a couple of those. Here's one of those. So 23 plus 8 is 31. Use the first 3, you're left with 5, and that gives you E. That's it. Simple, unbreakable. And whilst where you get on with that, I'm going to talk about another number station named UVB76, which actually isn't a number station, but we'll get onto that in a second. This one appears to have operated out of various sites inside Russia, and it was first heard in the late 70s, early 80s. And for 30 years, it was mostly remarkable only for its monotony. It just broadcasts its buzzing tone, which is interesting, but why bother broadcasting just a single buzzing tone for 30 years? As I mentioned earlier, it takes resource to run a station like this. So there's a few competing theories about why they may have been broadcasting this buzz. There's a very simple one, which says, well, maybe they were holding the particular channel open in case they ever needed it for some kind of emergency communication. There's a more paranoid theory, and it's actually the more popular theory. And that theory is that it's a dead man's switch. The idea is that if this broadcast was ever to have stopped, then that would have been a signal to a hidden receiver somewhere else in the world that it was time to unleash automatic Armageddon in a system of mutually assured destruction. Mostly, though, it just carried on buzzing like this. Which is interesting, but why bother? And then in 2010, things start to get weird. The site moves inside Russia, and different communications start to appear on the channel. This is a message broadcast on the 23rd of August, 2010. Now, I don't know if anyone speaks Russian.
93,
I don't.
882.
So we'll just skip over that. Now, the next one I'm going to play you was broadcast about a week later on the 2nd of September 2010. Remember, this is all unscrambled, broadcast in the clear on regular shortwave. As this, following on from this uptick in activity, repeaters begin to spring up, streaming this audio onto the internet, and that's when things get really weird. 4chan and Reddit get hold of the story as its fame spreads and it starts to become urban myth. Photos begin to pop up online, purporting to be from site visits to previous transmitter sites. The story gets muddy as it becomes part of internet culture and people start riffing on it. Let's go back to our decryption exercise. So, in order to go back to the decryption exercise, we need to reset the scene. You're alone in a strange city. It's December 1991. In 13 days, the USSR will be dissolved. It's the end of the Cold War. Times are changing. You recover your pad from its hiding place, and you start to decode. So that was a bit that I made up. But to be clear, the actual recording was genuine and the method was relatively genuine. It's a simplified method of, it was a simplified version of a more complex method. I gave you all a doctored pad. I can try to explain some of the maths later if you're interested. So wrapping up, I wanted to tell you about UVB 76 because it illustrates the point where the idea of a numbers station or something like it crosses over into net subculture, and the idea of secrets hidden in plain sight or mysterious artifacts in a public channel doing something that you can't quite figure out provide this kind of void, this information vacuum into which the imaginative can pour stories. March the 1st, 2013, The All, an internet publication out of New York, publishes an article claiming that inscrutable Twitter bots broadcasting these seemingly nonsense random bits of characters actually had some meaning and that these were the new number stations of the internet. In 2014, a number of outlets, including some which really should know better, got all hot under the collar about a YouTube channel named WebDriver Torso. Now, WebDriver Torso was posting videos which mainly looked and sounded like this. Ooh. Excuse me. So, Keynote has stalled on me, everybody. Wow, okay. Right. WebDriver Torso was posting videos which mainly looked and sounded like this. WebDriver Torso turned out to be a Google testing account. Or did it? These urban myths of the ether, these folk tales of the connected world, service a need for mystery that's followed us out of the woods and campfire circles via ghost stories onto our networks. The next time you encounter something incomprehensible on the internet or off the internet, maybe consider that it's not for you to comprehend. Maybe it's for the one person or machine in the world who can decode it. Thank you, that's me. There's a whole bunch of notes in that first URL there, and the second URL is the CONET project, which was basically all of the audio, most of the audio for this talk I got from there. So if you're going to check out one thing following this, check out the CONET project, it's amazing. Thank you.
We do have a couple of minutes if anybody has any questions. We can.
Does anyone have any questions? Oh, some hands go up. Okay, cool. A couple of guys here.
You mentioned the site in Cyprus and gave us the location.
Yes.
Were many other sites located, please?
Sorry?
Were many other of the sites located physically?
That's a good question. Yes. Essentially, like Enigma 2000 were distributed all over Europe, so they were kind of able to triangulate quite a few of the sites. I can't really name any at the top of my head, but if you Google Enigma 2000, there's a lot of stuff there, and then a lot of the sites have been tracked down, yeah.
If these were being used offensively in espionage, was there any attempt made to jam them?
Yes. So, I mean, the one I started with, the Lincolnshire Poacher, was quite regularly jammed. Because as well as broadcasting from Cyprus, there was also an Australian sister station called Cherry Ripe, which was broadcasting around parts of Southeast Asia. And frequently in that part of the world, the signals were getting jammed, yeah. Which, I mean, jammed in a really crude way. It's essentially just noise or a competing signal broadcast much more powerfully on the same channel. But yeah, they were frequently jammed. They had these really strange broadcast schedules. So most number stations wouldn't broadcast at the same time every day. They kind of broadcast at different point, different times during the day. And the actual time that they broadcast had this really strange, it was a very strange function. So it's very difficult to predict when they would be broadcast. Basically in order to avoid jamming, because if somebody who's trying to jam the broadcast doesn't know when it's going to be transmitted, then you've got a better chance of avoiding being jammed. So there's quite a lot of sort of cat and mouse going on in that space. There were actually, another thing that Enigma 2000 did was decode the transmission schedules and post them up so the listeners could listen in.
Following on from what you just said about the jamming, how would the remote agent know when and on what frequency to listen?
So, again, I mean, it's unclear because this is all, this is all essentially like second guessing. But the theory is that there would be an agreed schedule. But as I was saying to the guy just before you, there would effectively be a formula for calculating when the correct broadcast would be going out, and that would be like a function of the day and the time and the date and a lookup table that was unique to a particular agent. And then, by putting these things together, you could figure out the times that you were supposed to be listening. Again, it's all pretty hazy, but this is kind of like the product of a whole bunch of people theorizing about what might have been happening. So no one really knows what exactly was happening. There's a guy down here, and there's someone at the back as well.
I was just going to say, have you heard about the fairly recent North Korean number station?
Yeah, and that's really fascinating because there is a theory about number stations which says that, okay, so a number station is useful for a few things. One of the things it's useful for is if you've got a bunch of agents out in the field, you can communicate with them secretly, fine. But another theory that says, let's say you don't have that kind of resource. Let's say you're a small spy agency and you don't have the resources to send a bunch of people out into the field. It's much cheaper to run a shortwave station than it is to actually run agents. So you could broadcast a signal that looks as if it's going out to agents. And there's no agents out there, but you're actually doing a really good job of pretending to have, you're basically scaring your neighbors into thinking that you have a much more a far-reaching intelligence network than you actually do by broadcasting the signals that you broadcast if they were there. So it's kind of like a sort of second-level inception thing going on.
I'm going to ask, do you think that it is like a one-time pad or anything like that, or do you think it's psychological warfare?
I think it's psychological. I mean, the thing about this stuff is that it's mostly Cold War 80s tech, and there's no real need to be running this stuff when you've got the internet and strong crypto. I would reckon that anything that's going on at the moment is more psyops than it is actual, proper intelligence work.
Hi, yeah, just a follow-up question about UVB76. Talk about it being a sort of a dead man's switch. So I'm aware of there being this rumored system called Perimeter or Dead Hand. If you're aware of it, was there any link ever made to that system, or was it ever located within the USSR?
I'm afraid I didn't quite catch the question.
It's all right, I'll move on. It's fine, I'll catch you afterwards.
It's just a bit mumbly, that's all.
Okay, so a question on, it was on UVB-76,
yep,
the Russian one. So there were at least rumours of this sort of a USSR system called Perimeter or Dead yep. Hand. Were there any rumoured links to between the numbers station and that sort of system? And was UVB-76 ever located within Russia?
So UVB-76 was located a couple of times. I haven't read anything about its link to any other system. UVB-76 is even, the information that you can get online is even sketchier than the European stations because it's kind of at a greater level of remove. And I think that's another reason why UVB-76 took off so much online, because there was so little known about it that you could make up a whole lot of stories about it. So I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the short answer is I don't know for sure. And I should actually add that everything that I've just said, I basically got by doing a lot of research on the internet. So it's only true as far as you can tell by going down internet rabbit holes.
I was going to ask a question. The number stations obviously broadcasting out to agents, maybe.
Yes.
But is there any evidence that these agents had transmitters, were transmitting information back, or was it just a one-way system?
It's a one-way system. So the beauty of a number station is that in order to receive it, you don't need any specialized hardware. You just need a domestic shortwave radio. So it's a really deniable method of communication. So as soon as you add a transmitter, then you've got a lot more incriminating equipment with your operative. So the theory is that it was essentially one way, because it was one way allowed your operative to remain more secret, to operate with less suspiciously. Sorry?
So one of the things that surprised me about that excerpt that had Swan Lake in it was that it seems like there's a lot more sort of information, like metadata, in there than you would have with just pure numbers. So I wonder if it's been, wonder how common it is to have sort of high information content, recordings and things like that, and whether or not people have tried to say, well, that track comes from such and such a recording, or try to pinpoint things like that. Is that something that you've come across at all?
I missed the beginning of that.
So I mean, that little excerpt you've got there, I think it's Swan Lake that you've heard there. That sounds like it's come from like a recording, right? So you might be able to say, well, that's come from the recording on this record or that record or something. So you can pinpoint. There's inherent metadata there, isn't there, about if it was recorded by the Moscow Symphony Orchestra, that's different from if it was recorded by the New York Symphony Orchestra, right? That means two different things. So I'm just wondering, how common is it for that information to be there, available, and has anyone looked into that sort of thing?
So the theory is that the broadcast of that particular piece of music on UVB-76 was a mistake. There's a lot of really weird stuff about UVB-76 online, as you might imagine. Most people who are theorizing about where the actual source of the audio came from seem to think that it was actually a room that physically had a speaker and a microphone, and a buzzer and a microphone. And it wasn't anything more complicated than that, because people who were listening to it would occasionally hear like people shuffling around in the background, or like things being knocked off shelves, or people swearing or whatever. So the theory is that Swan Lake going out was a mistake, and it was somebody playing it elsewhere in the station. It just happened to go out. That's what I've read.
Thank you, everyone. You've just got half an hour before the film festival starts in this tent. That gives you half an hour to go to the volunteer area and volunteer to work a shift. This festival is run by volunteers, so please do register. Thank you very much, everyone.